Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler. You know, it's Christmas Day as we release this episode, I think. Thursday the 25th, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct.
So, but no matter what your holiday preferences are, I hope that you have an excellent, relaxing time of it. Helene Sanduk.
Hi.
Lisa Weir. Greg Woods.
Hey.
Casey
Hello.
McCleary.
Hey.
Casey McCleary. And that your relatives are not making you crazy. Do you guys have this problem with your relatives?
I don't think I want to answer that.
I think a good time to say that would be in a worldwide distributed podcast.
Yeah, considering some of them listen to this, I'm going to say no. They're all wonderful.
My relatives are too tech savvy for me, to be honest.
Wow, I don't think my mom knows what a podcast is. I don't. They don't really have internet, so I'm pretty safe.
Or fire hydrants.
Or fire hydrants. I am really showing my.
We should explain that, probably.
No, I'm totally explaining
today.
That. Before the show, Lisa confessed that she didn't know that it was illegal to park in front of fire hydrants.
Until she
got a ticket. Very week.
There's a good reason for that.
It was last week, but yes.
There was also a good 3 minutes or so when we all thought we were sarcastically joking.
I know,
we
were like, ah, ha, 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 ha.
Why don't they teach you that?
Yeah, I've really
Lisa.
Never been taught that.
But only because it didn't come up very often.
In small town Iowa, if you're not from small town, I guess in Lisa's hometown, they put fire hydrants on the corners where you're not allowed to park anyway. I'd never encounter. I have always known.
Makes perfect sense.
It does kind of make sense, although I would think that the best place for a fire hydrant would be in the middle of the block. But that's just because
I
grew up with.
Our blocks are really small, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, she's got a block to work with, it
yeah.
looks like.
Pretty small town.
So anyway, yeah, she just, it's just a product of her upbringing. Her parents did not raise her right, apparently.
Ooh.
Whoa. Are you going to take
Whoa.
That?
It's I okay.
Are you
going to
take that from him?
Just kidding. Just kidding, parents. You did a fine job.
They can't hear it. They don't have internet.
She's in med school.
No, they have like 1 gigabyte a month. So they could theoretically like download this and only this.
Use it wisely.
Yeah. Nice.
Yes. So I wanted to start off the show today by talking about a landmark 1972 study of physician attributes that showed that physicians have a bunch of psychological vulnerabilities. Self-criticism, a refusal to seek help, pessimism, passivity, self-doubt, feelings of inferiority. You guys are a mess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
but we're not allowed to talk about it.
Well, yes, you are. The authors felt that such traits predict personal and psychological dysfunction later in life, which I thought was interesting. How do you guys feel about this information? Does this jibe with what you know?
Do you think it takes a certain amount of psychological dysfunction to, like, put yourself through the process of getting into med school and getting through med school, and then it's just a byproduct of, like, all the normal people who are like, oh, heck with this?
I would say yes, because another couple of studies that I had read, one, and I think we may have all heard about this one, is different subjects were asked to stick their hand in a terribly cold bucket of ice water for as long as they possibly could. And they found that med students would keep their hands in there for longer than nearly any other group of people.
I'm
going to show that box of
really
ice
does.
Right there. Who's
so
boss?
In a similar study, as I recall, and I may be getting the details wrong on this one, but there was some sort of reward that was promised to people if they would endure some physical pain. And as you might imagine, the med students were willing to endure more physical pain to get some promised reward than nearly any other group of people. So in a way, this does not surprise me one bit.
We're so tough.
Or stubborn. Or you know.
Foolish.
Yeah, any number of things.
Wow.
I think these attributes actually have revealed themselves a lot lately in the very high, distressingly high number of physician suicides. It's like 400 per year, I think. And I think that reflects our ability or our inability to show our vulnerability to each other and feeling like we can't talk about things even though we should, and even though we have a lot of people have these insecurities and we go through very stressful jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So
what was the date of that study?
72.
72. I think there's a big generational aspect, too, to that. Because when you think about the kinds of people who went to med school back then, like, it wasn't cost prohibitive. You had to be of a certain ethnicity, of a certain social class. Like, medicine's way more diverse now. And true. I'd say, I don't know if that necessarily applies. Like, some things definitely stuck out to me that I recognize about myself, but I don't know if it's 100% spot on anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it's been, I don't know, 50 years. A long time. Some mathematical equation that results in a number that I cannot calculate in my head.
Yes.
Oh, man. Well, meanwhile, Oxford psychologist Kevin Dutton's book, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success, identified the top 10 most and least psychopathic professions. So let's start with most psychopathic, because that's the most entertaining.
Please.
Number one is CEO.
Yep.
Number two is lawyer. Yeah. Number three.
I'm from DC. I know all about this.
People are quick to get on this.
Number three is media, or actually TV and radio. I don't know that podcasts were included.
This is awkward.
Oops. Number four is salesperson. Number five, surgeon. Number six, journalist. Number seven, police officer. Eight, clergy person. Nine, chef.
Clergy person?
Yeah. Clergy person.
The chef is disconcerting.
The chef, that's
think of that.
I know, we have no problem with clergy, but apparently, you know, we don't...
They're preparing our food.
We don't want people... As the article I read, somebody who has their own engraved set of knives, you know, probably has a situation. And number 10, civil servant. So, there you go. At least psychopathic. Number one, care aide. Number two, nurse. Number three, therapist. Number four, craftsperson. Number five, beautician/stylist. Number six, charity worker. Number seven, teacher. Number eight, creative artist. Number nine, doctor.
Yeah.
Number 10, accountant.
Wow.
Accountant?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're an accountant, I assume that you must... I mean,
you're too dweeby.
I was going to say, you don't have a lot of...
My old roommate was an accountant, and I take offense to
my
that
mother
for her.
Is an, no, I'm just kidding. My mom's not dweeby. But
she's an accountant?
Yeah.
I mean, how psychopathic can you be crunching numbers all day long, doing long division?
I mean, there may be other problems, but...
That might make you. I don't know.
What were the criteria for this study?
Yeah.
Oh,
who's responsible,
you know, there
for
was
this?
There was an actual definition of...
I was going to say, is this
what
like,
psychopath means,
like
but
they
basically...
they took the actual psychopath test?
I believe that's the case.
Hmm.
Huh. I love the fact that surgeon is number five.
I can see that.
They have to be very, like, emotionally disconnected to be digging around in people all day, I feel like.
To cut into a human being, basically, all day, every day.
To have the confidence to do that. Well, I mean, that's part of the... Yeah. I mean, a lot of these on the plus psychopathy list... Psychopathy? Psychopathy list. You know, they all require a certain amount of confidence and a certain... I don't know, just a certain ability to resist the lack of confidence that I have, for instance. I mean, I don't think I'm a psychopath. I guess if I was, I wouldn't really realize it.
I mean, so what's the definition of psychopath?
Good question.
Somebody internet that for me.
I think it's a term people misappropriate a lot, because there's a medical definition, and then there's like a, this guy's such an asshole.
Well, I'm going to go with the idea that like an alcoholic. Oxford psychologist probably knows the definition of a psychopath, but we should probably
let's ask
for
Dr.
the
Google.
Viewers.
Yeah, so the first one that pops up is a rather generic definition of a person suffering from chronic mental disorder with abnormal or violent social behavior.
Okay, so
as opposed to a sociopath.
I don't know if I'm going to go with that one, because not all psychopaths are violent.
Okay, and the sociopath, that is a very commonly mixed in definition. So first definition there says, a person with a personality disorder manifesting itself in extreme antisocial attitudes and behavior and a lack of conscience.
Lack of conscience, that's what I was
waiting
for.
That's one of the big things.
Right.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I was thinking was the definition. And that's what I believe that's what I read when I looked at this article. I should have written down the definition.
I mean, there's a reason why people go into surgery as opposed to like establishing long-term relationships with patients. I mean, right. A lot of the people that I know, whoa.
You don't want to have a long-term...
What's with the dagger series?
You don't want to have a long-term relationship with your surgeon, you know? That would be... That would be kind of...
And expensive.
Yes.
Oh, you're back. Oh, you want to check out my new Ferrari?
Every time you visit with your surgeon, there's a little piece of you missing.
Aw. Funny in a lot of ways.
Well, and I think that's not... I think this isn't just for any surgeons listening. Not... meant to be calling you all psychopaths.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that in Iowa City we are surrounded by those sorts of people. So we love you. We just want to say
it may just be for the more mechanically inclined amongst us.
And if you want to look me up, my name is Lisa Simpson. I live at 742 Evergreen Terrace. Come talk to me about it.
Aria, so it's what's tragic here is that none of you are able to identify yourselves as psychopathic, which would be very interesting. Do we have any?
I'm not going to be a doctor, not a surgeon.
Isn't there like a real psychopath test? We could totally take it. It would be fun.
We could put our results up for the next show.
Yeah.
That would be a fantastic idea.
I mean,
let's put our results of the psychopathy test.
PsychCentral.com has a
on the
has
internet
a quiz.
And we all have time to do this now. No one can back
it's
out
break.
Of it.
That's true. Yeah. The one and only question is, are you a psychopath? No, I'm kidding. No.
Are there any questions that you can ask us?
Oh, sure, yeah.
If we hurt this puppy, will you be sad?
Yes.
So a lot of these are, and as I scroll through them, are kind of on a Likert scale of you know, how much you agree with it, how much you identify with it. So things like, most would describe me as charming and nonchalant. I can turn my charm on and off like a faucet. So then you have the list. Do you agree with this? Do you disagree? Are you indifferent? So there are a lot of things like that. You're trying to... They're not going to ask you, are you a psychopath? Because that won't work, obviously.
That's exactly what a psychopath would say.
Yeah,
so, I think we should all do this, and then whoever doesn't report back next semester will know the answer.
We'll assume, yeah.
Well, we could go down the hall and give it to all the interviewees.
Oh, yeah. No, they really would love that.
I'm really considering this question of whether I can turn my charm on and off.
Turn your charm on and off?
I mean, can't
everybody turn their charm on and off a little bit?
But like a faucet?
I don't know if I can like a faucet, but I feel like I have
I'm not a schmoozer.
I could totally be a schmoozer if I want to.
You gotta like psych up for it though.
Yeah. I was gonna say, like, it's not like a faucet. It's more like it's more like a jar of orange juice on the top shelf. Like, if I really, really want it, I can get there.
That's a good...
Climb on the counter and get up there.
Yeah.
I like that. I see. Okay, another one then. I do what I want, when I want, the moment the impulse strikes me, regardless of what others want.
God,
No.
Is that just because med school doesn't give us the time?
Yes.
No, I just really hate myself. That's all. I'm just kidding.
I consider other people actually far too much, I think.
Yeah, I think I do too.
I think a lot of people are like that, or at least they try to, even if they don't successfully.
Spend a lot of time thinking about it. I think that would be the definition of not.
And yet the world still really sucks.
I should also point out that finals have just ended today, and so not everybody is in a great mood. I don't know.
Another one of my favorites is, I've gotten into legal or criminal trouble as an adult, parentheses, including parking next to a fire hydrant. All right, maybe that's not what's in there. I don't know. But
some people just don't care about people's access to water during a fire emergency. I mean,
actually, this kind of makes me think back to the first question about charm, because, you know, I was going to be like, this is my first ticket I've ever gotten for any sort of, like, parking or driving or anything. That's not true. I did get a parking ticket once a long time ago.
The lie starts to unravel already.
But I kind of forgot about that one. But I've been pulled over 5 or 6 times and never, ever gotten a citation for it. Charm, guys.
I always get charm.
Teach us.
Do you cry?
Teach us your
powers. I know, I've never cried, actually.
I can't see her crying.
Every time I've gotten in a traffic I just sob. Not on purpose, though.
The only thing that makes me cry is one time I hit a cat, and I cried for an entire hour afterwards.
Okay, not a psychopath.
That's reasonable.
Okay, that would knock you down on the scale.
Good.
See? Yeah. Called it.
I'm so sad. I I got like 2 tickets in 1 week last year, 2 speeding tickets in 1 week.
You need to work on turning your charm on and off.
I do. And you know, well, one was by mail because I got the camera.
Picturing Dave.
The camera in Cedar Rapids.
But that's not fair. You can't charm a camera.
I know, exactly. And the other one was on Dubuque Street near the,
Oh, I hate that one.
Near the fraternity. There's a few frat houses in there.
It's a trap.
And, yeah, I really try to, you know, I always try to be honest, you know, when I get pulled over, because I figure if I'm not honest,
they'll know.
They're going to be like, well, okay, so I'm going to look at this machine that tells me that you did, so.
You're in for a key patrol, son.
It still hasn't worked. I mean, yeah. I still get a ticket, so. I don't get tickets. That's
consider it a donation to your community.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Yeah, so I would like to note, just so that we don't seem too callous, that I mean, psychopathy and sociopathy is a real condition that is can be problematic for people and affects like a very high population or percentage of people in jail. And we don't, as a society, we don't really know how to deal with it, or is it a thing that people can be helped with? Is it a thing that we need to help people with? Is it part of the normal range of human expression? So well, just so we don't seem too callous, it is a psychological conundrum of sorts.
If, you know, the definition of psychopathy as being a personality disorder, and personality disorders, I think, have been very hard for us to modify, to treat.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so that's why that's why it's such a big problem. God, you really know how to bring us down.
I'm sorry.
Good point. Thank you.
Debbie Downer.
We'll be back in just a minute on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
I guess I didn't even realize this was released on Christmas Day, so it's even more pertinent.
Oh, good.
Sierra Leone is banning public Christmas and New Year's celebrations in their attempts to reduce the spread of the Ebola virus. So,
oh.
Sad.
Yeah.
I bummed out until you said Ebola virus, and I was like, oh.
I know. That makes sense. I know. The first headline I saw was something on Twitter, and it was like, Sierra Leone cancels Christmas. And I was like, what? And then I realized that it was a public health measure attempting to, you know, their really intent was to stop people from, like, traveling across the country and spreading it to rural areas that might not have it yet and stuff. So to really keep people from traveling, and also, you know, close quarters tend to spread a lot of diseases and stuff. So they do have good intentions, but
I thought the main problem with Ebola was not necessarily people congregating in one place, but people dying and getting their bodily fluids all over the place.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. So is this?
You don't have to be dead to spread your bodily fluids.
No, as long as the bodily fluids have started spreading.
Let's keep saying bodily fluids.
That's gross. Yeah. But you don't. I mean, it's not like.
Well, I mean, I think it's like if you are sick and you don't know it yet, but then you like get sick on the trip or on the way, and then they don't have the proper facilities to deal with that, and now it's all over there, and then if you die, then people are like touching your body, and now it's everywhere. Nobody wants Ebola for Christmas. That's worse than coal.
No, that's very. It is worse than coal. Not much worse.
Can we talk about something that has been on my mind though because of Christmas?
Yes.
I feel like a lot of people in the media romanticize poverty at Christmas. And it's just a side note, but I feel like people, you know, looking back fondly on a childhood where they thought they were poor, and I'm like, not getting what you wanted for Christmas doesn't make you poor.
Can I complain about someone on Facebook? Okay, so.
Alrighty.
I know. So, this person on my Facebook who just drives me crazy. He just posts the most ridiculous things all the time. But he was... I posted something about poverty, and he got on there and he commented about how he knows what it's like to be poor because he remembers having to move into a smaller apartment and get rid of their dog because they couldn't afford their bigger apartment anymore, but like they have, they lived in a nice house. I knew this family.
It sounds like,
he doesn't have any idea what it's like to be poor. And I was just so angry
that he was out here like,
I know what poverty is because I had to sell my dog. Like that never happens to anyone. Like, it just made me so angry.
It sounds like he knows what it's like to have something unfortunate happen. But,
but he doesn't know what it's like to be poor. And back to what you were saying, I think that's, I agree.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of glamour about like, oh, being really generous at Christmas towards poor people and then just kind of forget about them the rest of the year.
Yeah. A status is not, you know, dedicating a status to poor people is like,
are we trying?
Okay, thanks a lot for that.
I'm going to tweet about
Are we trying
them.
To prove that we're not psychopathic at this point?
No, I just, don't we all have those Facebook friends that, you know, like for some reason, like you don't really know that person anymore, and you don't agree with them on anything, and then you put stuff on your Facebook, and then they have the audacity to show up on your your house!
Yeah!
In your house! He came to your house!
He came to my house!
That's right! And tried to tell you how to live your life. That's uncool.
He tried to talk to me about social justice.
Damn straight. You put him in his place.
I wasted so many hours of my life arguing with this person on Facebook.
Oh my god, I have no patience for Facebook debates.
I can't. I banned myself on it. I just won't do it anymore.
Yeah. It gets you so fired up.
Wow,
I'm really just talking to myself here.
I feel you.
Adam, Lisa, Dave, jump on in.
No, I've really just stopped. I've just decided that Facebook is not the place to do it. There are some places where I really want to correct misinformation and I really want to put, and I'm just like, no, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to stay cordial and.
It's an echo chamber a little bit, you know, throw stuff out there and no matter what happens, you're going to get either, it gets reflected back at you as something people agree with or it doesn't and you don't change anybody's mind.
And everybody leaves angry and
everybody
complains
leaves angry.
To their significant others and then their significant others tell them to shut up.
And that's why how specific. And that's why I enjoy the block feature.
I should probably take better advantage of that.
I have like probably 200 people on my Facebook blocked.
Yeah,
like a lot.
It's not going well.
Yeah. Hey, whoa. What are you trying to say?
She didn't say how many she has unblocked.
Yeah. You don't know these people. They deserve to be blocked.
All right.
There are at least 200 people in the world who deserve to be blocked.
They've earned their blocked status. That's right.
Well, I'm going to try to uplift us a little bit by going back to Ebola.
Worst Christmas episode ever.
But it's not what you think. No, this is actually a good story, and I was very surprised to read this. This is in Liberia. There's a 22-year-old girl named Fatou Kekula who has been in the news recently because of what she has done for her family in the midst of this Ebola crisis. And it started off when her father got sick and was taken to a hospital where he was put in a bed that had just recently been cleared by someone who died from Ebola. So he ended up getting it and spread it to the family back home. All of the hospitals nearby were rejecting them because they said we're over full, we can't handle this. So what this girl decided to do is she would take care of them herself, but she wouldn't get infected. So she thought, how can I do this? She wanted to be a nursing student. So she knew a little bit about how everything worked with the whole exposure and the precautions that she took. So she came up with this system of trash bags and tying them around herself and all of these different layers and these masks and things. And essentially she created her own suit to be able to take care of her family members, all of whom but one lived through their bouts with Ebola. Now, that's around 25% death rate, which is a lot better than the 70% that they have elsewhere in the world. So that isn't the best feel-good part of the story, though, because it's still sad. She lost a family member, and, you know, the circumstances were difficult. But through hearing about this, some people reached out and said, we are going to raise money for you. And they got in contact with her and helped her apply to Emory University in Atlanta, where she will be going starting next year to become a nurse, hopefully, by these donations and from hearing her rather remarkable story about taking care of them.
It's a feel-good story.
Isn't it?
Yes.
I thought so.
This is what I keep hearing about third world countries and their medical problems is that, so the thing about the precautions with Ebola is that, you know, when we Westerners look at it, it's often like, you know, well, we have to do this very complicated thing. We have to, you know, use these specialized materials. We have to have a big training regimen to get people to understand the precautions. And it's, you know, when the feet hit the ground, it maybe doesn't work well enough for non-Western countries or countries that are very, you know, resource limited. And then every once in a while I hear these stories about people who are like, yeah, I just put some trash bags on myself and thought about it for a while and it worked out. You know, like, that's the sort of thing that you can do, you know, in a resource poor environment.
Sometimes and technology is a hindrance. We rely on it too much.
Yeah, we definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for us to not think about how can we use technology to do this, or how can we, because we don't see it anymore. We don't see that Tyvek or whatever they use for is actually a technology. You know, it's just a thing that we go to, you know, Home Depot and wrap our houses with, you know, so big deal, right?
Wait, is that what that plastic stuff is called that goes over your windows?
Yeah.
I've been looking for that.
No.
Like
that's
a month. Stuff?
No. Oh,
the like the clear plastic, the shrink stuff that goes over your windows?
What is that?
I don't know.
Plastic on your windows.
It's like Duck brand. You can get it at Walmart and buy the space heaters and stuff. Okay. I get it every year.
I keep awkwardly going up to people in like grocery stores and being like, hey, do you guys sell the stuff that I can, like, put on my windows?
Walmart and
I can, like,
tape it
and
like,
hair dry it
around
my windows, and they just give me the weirdest look ever. Like,
sometimes
well,
Target,
somewhere
but I haven't seen it lately, so. Actually, that kind of brings me to another story I had that was, we talk about low-tech stuff that's not really tech necessarily. This is the ability to balance on one leg can actually indicate your brain health. So, cerebral small vessel disease was associated with being unable to balance on one leg for more than 20 seconds. So they had these people and they had them stand on one leg, both eyes open, and just saw how long they could do it. And then, you know, afterwards, they put them in an MRI machine and looked for like small infarcts and stuff. And they found out that really one of the best tests to test for stuff that necessarily don't have other symptoms is just have these people stand on one leg. And so if you can't stand on one leg for 20 seconds, that might be your only symptom, but you're much more likely to have a small infarct.
So, oh, wow.
This is like, why we talk about low-tech, cheap tests. There is one.
I guess this is why they teach us all that weird little random stuff for physical exams. Like, it actually can matter.
Yeah.
So there's a guy at some point somewhere who wrote a book, the title of which I can't remember right now, but I'm going to summarize it for you guys.
This is starting well. And then,
great story.
He said some things, and
I was inspired.
Listen, there's a lot going on in my head right now. I can't remember this right now.
But none of it's relevant to the story.
But okay, so here's where it gets interesting for you guys. This guy basically wrote a book detailing the history of medical technology. Hmm. And basically emphasized that like even before we had stethoscopes, you'd have to put your ear to the patient's chest to hear their heartbeat. And then they, you know, developed the stethoscope. And then they had the hospital bed. And like with every new piece of technology that was supposed to empower us with an enhanced ability to care for patients, it put more physical distance between the patient and the doctor. And it's, you know, it's little tests like these that kind of bring you back to like just the fundamental skill of like just observing your patients and focusing on them.
Who is it? Is it Abraham Verghese that is? Yeah, I think he's the one that is big on coming back to the physical exam, and Stanford has this big push on bringing back the physical exam and making sure everyone has really good physical exam skills, because it is. It's one of the best, cheapest ways to find this kind of stuff. I think the Stanford 25, they've determined, are like the top 25 things to teach their students. And I believe they also do it with residents. They, you know, we go in and get tested on our physical exam skills, but a lot of times when you're a resident, that doesn't happen. And Stanford does that with their residents too. They go in and they get tested and they get feedback on here's how you can improve. And it's not meant to be, oh, we're going to fail you necessarily. But it's meant, you know, this is how you can do this better and get more worth out of it.
That's a good idea. Yeah. I always complain when we have, like, our physical exam quizzes and stuff. I'm like, ugh, why do I have to percuss this liver? Why do I have to try to hear this tapping? I can't hear this tapping. I just use an x-ray. But, like, that's so much more expensive and invasive and time-consuming. And if you could just tap and see if a liver is enlarged, like, that is pretty obviously ideal.
This is pertinent actually to the story that I was originally going to tell before we talked about Ebola, and that is a new product that's coming out from a company called CellScope. It's called Odo Home, and it's basically the end of a little otoscope, and you hook it to your iPhone.
Want.
And what it does is it can help you figure out if your child or anybody has an ear infection. And the way that it does this is it will send in the picture or video to this central place where there are doctors, and they will actually do the looking at it for you.
Who have the most boring job in the world.
And tell you, that they'll send you a note back and say, yes, that's an ear infection, or no, that isn't. And it's $79. Each remote consultation that you do costs $50, except you get the first one for free, so that's good. You've already got an ear in hand. There's also... There's also a $300 professional version.
And an ear in hand is worth two in the book.
That actually will puff air and figure out how the ear responds to changes in pressure. So this is just something that you hook up to your iPhone. And in a way, it is, you know, trying to bridge that gap if you live, you know, somewhere far away and you can't get to a doctor. But at the same time, I feel like it's also kind of distancing from the whole thing of you know, hey, let's just take a picture and send it to the doctor.
And that is the one of the big stumbling blocks for telemedicine, which has so much. I mean, it's, first of all, telemedicine is all over my feeds lately. I mean, it's everywhere. I can't not look at my news feeds lately and not see telemedicine. And it seems like a great, you know, innovation in medical care, especially for rural people, but it also means that, you know, that doctors don't get to, like,
I think it's inferior care.
There are definitely pros and cons. I think you can.
It's better than no care.
It's better than no care.
I don't think it has to be inferior care necessarily. It probably is to a certain extent right now. But I mean, I feel like if we develop the technology far enough, then it could be pretty close, except for the human contact.
Well, that's
human
but that's
contact
an important.
Is very important.
That's
important.
Very important.
It
yeah.
is very important.
And take from this what you will. It is only available right now in California and people, owners of iPhone 5s and 5Ss.
Hippies. Oh, but not 6.
Nope.
I'll take that, people who think you need new stuff. I could get it. I have an iPhone 5.
Whoa. Me too.
I know, right?
Me too. Will they let us use that on tests?
I have an iPhone 4S, so yeah. That's what's up.
We go.
Old school over there.
That's impressive.
So I actually have another technology-related article.
I love how you just said it was impressive that I had an iPhone 4S. I was like, well, look at this Western decadence.
I mean, you made it last that long. Like,
I mean, it's heavily damaged, wow. But that's really so people don't steal it.
That's a good plan.
Not because you're a klutz.
Not at all because I'm a klutz, obviously.
Very good.
Sorry, Casey.
No, you're fine. I'm just thinking of how my friend in high school used to put mustard on his tater tots so no one would steal them at lunch, and that's kind of what your broken phone reminds me of.
That's right.
You ruin your own things so that no one else will take them.
Okay.
So anyway.
Right on.
An interesting strategy.
If I can't have it, no one can. So anyway, I have another very high-tech story. The world's first two-arm mechanical prosthetics replacement has been done at Johns Hopkins, and it is amazing. They did a surgery to wire the arms into his nerves. He's missing both arms from the shoulder down. Some sort of accident. I didn't find any details.
Electrical accident.
Oh.
40 years ago, in fact.
Really?
Yes.
So this is old scars. This is not
absolutely.
Like fresh nervous tissue or anything. But they had, they went in and they like took all the nerves and they attached it to the robotic parts and they trained him on a computer program to think certain things that could move his arms in certain ways. And they correlated those thoughts to the arm movements. And now he can move his arms just by thinking about it.
We live in the future, guys.
We do.
Like
every time I look at the news, we live in the future.
Like we have these like little rectangle things with a screen that you can touch. You know, I was working on my notepad the other day and I went to zoom in on the thing that I had just drawn and I was confused for like a split second why I wouldn't zoom in. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. That is so cool. Especially when you think that these are separate movements. That what he's doing in each of his arms are not the same thing. So it's not mirrored on both sides. This is the first time, which makes this really important, that each arm can do something different at the same time.
I was a little confused by this because I thought that I read, I thought that I saw him moving his two arms independently at the same time. But then I thought I also read that capability is not ready yet. You have to do one thing at a time with this device at this moment. I don't think that's out of the question in the future, but anyway, it doesn't matter.
Either way, it's really,
not sure
totally,
about the
totally really
so cool.
But yeah, he will be able to, at some point in the near future, wear them home and just have them in his everyday life. So this isn't just an in-the-lab thing. Like, this is real life for this guy.
Wow.
on that positive note, we're going to finish up for today. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays. Christmas Hanukkah Kwanzaa.
Uh-oh. Did I just make a social gaffe? Happy holidays, everyone. Sorry about that.
Happy winter solstice.
Whatever you celebrate, happy of that.
If you liked what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or unusual or weird or upsetting happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, if you want to suggest a story idea for us, leave us a message at theshortcoat.com. Do follow us and talk to us on Twitter so we can stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by the strange world we live in and a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producers are Dave Etler and Jason Lewis. Our opening theme music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week. Oh,